Okay, hello. Well, I'm not sure how I follow that intro, but that's very nice. So I'm Rach Sandrew. I'm a web developer. And yes, I'm co-founder of the small CMS Perch and its bigger friend Perch Runway. And I'm going to talk to you for the next little while about how we used a pattern library when we were working on the redesign of the UI for Perch when we launched Perch 3. And just sharing some of the things that we kind of learned as we were going through that process. It was the first time that we'd really used pattern libraries. And I think some of this stuff might be interesting, particularly if you're working on a project that isn't a traditional website and you've got sort of different challenges than just building a website with your pattern library. So that's the Perch pattern library. It is online. As of a couple of days ago, we put it up, so you can go and you can have a look at it. And the slides I'll be sharing with URLs and things afterwards. So Perch is 8 years old. The product turned 8 in May, and so about a year or so ago, we decided we were going to launch Perch 3, and it was going to have a redesigned UI. We've got a lot of customers, and so redesigning the UI is a slightly scary prospect because you don't want to make things worse and upset people. So it's also a very different experience to redeveloping a website, and so you need to know a little bit about how Perch works in case you've not come across it, to understand why it was such a challenge. Perch takes this sort of structured content approach. That's the core of Perch. So instead of having like a big text area when you want to go and edit a page, you have a wide range of field types that you can put together to make up your templates. And this means that when content's entered, you're capturing it as the type of content that it is. So if you need a date, you're going to have a date field type and so on. So this is my site where I'm adding the details of this conference, and I've defined fields for all the bits of information I want to gather so I can use them well. And then I select my conference template when setting up that collection. And this is the template. It's basically an HTML fragment, contains all the markup I need to display that content on the front end. It also contains all the field types using Perch template tags. And those define the schema, and they define the form that shows up in admin. And as well as this, we've got an API. So you've got the field types, which could be in any order in anyone's forms. You also have an API. So people might be developing their own field types, which are things that we've never seen before. They might be adding things like dividers and help text around the field types. They also may have developed some kind of custom add-on to Perch that we've not seen. So really, we've got no idea what any individual customer looking at the Perch control panel is actually seeing. And sometimes when we see screenshots in support, we're kind of like, is that our software? You know, it doesn't look like something that we had in front of us when we were doing the design. And we've also got our own add-ons and the third-party add-ons, which all need to fit in to the same UI. We want, if someone's using an add-on, it should look the same as the rest of Perch, because otherwise it's a sort of jarring experience for the person using it. And so the Perch UI absolutely has to exist as a set of components because those field types can be stacked up in any order. You know, how someone actually uses them is different every time. And so I've been speaking at a bunch of events, as Joey mentioned. I talk at a lot of conferences, so I sit in a lot of conference talks, and I think pretty much every speaker so far has mentioned Brad Frost's work. And I heard Brad talking about atomic design. I thought, yeah, you know, this sounds like the sort of thing that we could use for the Perch UI. We could take these atomic design principles and we could make components in a pattern library and then use those to build up the Perch UI. I'd also read things that Anna Debenham had written. She's written a lot about style guides and pattern libraries, and you know, I was sort of quite influenced by all of that kind of happening at the time. So I was pretty sure that what we needed was a pattern library. That was how we were going to start rebuilding the Perch UI, was in a pattern library. And, you know, I know HTML and CSS. The end output is HTML and CSS. So I thought, well, let's just build this, keep it simple. I'll just, you know, create HTML files with all the patterns in, and that would be a really simple way to work. We won't have to sort of mess around with any extra tooling. So I started to do that. And I started generating this enormous HTML document with all of the different patterns that I could think in. You know, even just starting with all the different buttons, and then you've got an awful lot of HTML, and you're copying and pasting HTML. And then you're like, oh, I need to change the markup because we've decided, changed how we're going to do the SVGs, and I'm copying and pasting all the HTML to make that change. That wasn't ideal. And I thought, you know, when we get to having shipped this, even if I manage to keep this thing updated as we build the new UI, the minute we ship Perch, are we going to go back and make changes to this document every time we make a change, you know, to Perch? Probably not. It was a pain to update, even, you know, a couple of weeks in. This wasn't great. And as was mentioned earlier by Laura, you know, if you don't have this thing as a living thing, if it's not being updated all the time, you might as well not have it, because it's just going to get out of date and you're going to ignore it within a year's time. So that wasn't great. I figured working in HTML, that's just not working. So what tools are there out there? And this was, you know, sort of over a year ago. So sort of looking around, I started to examine the different kinds of pattern library tools that were out there. And the problem I discovered, and I sort of started trying out a few of them, they all assumed I was building a website. They were like, here's your homepage. I don't have a homepage. I've got this collection of stuff. I don't even know what this is going to look like. They didn't really work, and that was getting a little bit frustrating. I was thinking, you know, am I going to have to build something myself here? So if you're going to build something yourself, we need to figure out what you actually need, what your goals are for your own pattern library. So I had to think about this. I stopped working on the actual pattern library and thought, what do I need from this pattern library? I wanted somewhere that we could document any design decisions, particularly once the new version of Perch was live. If we made changes, if we discovered that, say, there was an accessibility problem with something, we made changes, I'd want to be able to go back and make a note in the pattern library of what we'd done and why we'd done it, so we wouldn't make the same mistake again. I thought it would be handy, you know, we want to have a system to organise these components, to actually make some sense and some structure out of the stuff, you know, in the pattern library, so we could see where things were. I really, really wanted to make sure that all this work was kept up to date, and that, you know, in the future, we could still rely on it as being the source of truth for all of the things that are in Perch. And I also thought, well, we've got all these people developing add-ons for Perch, and it's really nice if they can make their add-ons look like the rest of Perch, and it's better for the end user, the content editor, to be able to go in and see everything looking like one consistent system. And so it'd be great if we could make this library available to all of our add-on developers, because then they'd know, oh, if I use this HTML, if I use this class, then my thing is going to look like everything else. That would be a real nice side benefit of having a pattern library. As I say, all the things that I was finding, though, assumed that we were just building a website. I wasn't building a website. And then I discovered Fractal, which is the tool that comes from ClearLeft. And the brilliant thing about Fractal is that it's pretty agnostic about what you're building. It doesn't care what you're building. It's like, you need a pattern library. We're a pattern library. Now you work out how you want to organize this stuff. And that was perfect for what we needed, because what we had wasn't like what anybody else had. We needed to be able to make our own decisions about how things were organized. And although Fractal was actually in a very early stage itself and changed quite a bit during the time we were building the Perch UI, you know, we were happy about that because it saved us an awful lot of time rolling our own thing. And we were able to kind of develop the pattern library along with Fractal getting better and better as we were working on it, which was great. So these are some of the reasons why we sort of liked Fractal. It was the fact it didn't expect us to have a homepage. It left all the organization up to us. It also didn't dictate which build tools we used. You know, we could decide how we wanted to build our CSS, what we did with that. That was up to us. It had a method to store documentation along with the patterns. And it let us do things like export to HTML so we could share this with other people. So I want to talk about the actual process of working with Fractal, or really with any tool, but the things that we learned as we went through that. Because, you know, it's one thing to work with a pattern library while you're in that nice phase of developing a new thing. And you're working in the pattern library, that's where you spend your days building the components. But then, yeah, you know, once the thing ships, you get that situation where you think, I just need to make a really quick change to the CSS. And so you make it in the project, not in the pattern library. And then you need to make another quick change. You're like, oh, at the end of the week, I'll roll these things back into the pattern library. And then it's like the end of the next month, and you're like, what changes did we make? And you're kind of diffing code, and you're like, oh, whatever, it doesn't matter. It's done now. We didn't want that to happen. And so what we decided, because of the very neat way that Fractal works and allows you to use whatever kind of build system you want to use, we decided that we would make Fractal the source of truth. We'd make it so you couldn't actually build CSS in Perch itself. You know, we couldn't go and make a change to the CSS in the Perch code base. We'd have to make a change to the CSS in Fractal, in the pattern library itself. So where our CSS for Perch is generated is actually inside Fractal. It's in the pattern library. You can't change the CSS for the Perch UI in Perch. What ends up in Perch is there's a script that runs when Perch is built, when the product's built, before we ship a new release. It grabs the built CSS out of the pattern library, puts that into the package, and that's what then people download and use when they download Perch. So we can't be tempted to think, oh, I just need to fix that thing, I'll fix it in the Perch source code, because that's not where we do CSS. That's just the built compiled file is over there. So this is a little view of what that all looks like. So we've got each component. So here's a little component of part of the Perch UI. So each component has its template file. And then we also have the SAS, which goes along with that. Now, this is how we do this for Perch, but I'm actually using exactly the same process on all of the other sites. So things like all of our Perch sites all live in Fractal. The redesign of my personal site that I'm working on, that's all in Fractal. I'm doing exactly the same thing. I'm building my CSS in the pattern library, and then I just deploy the built CSS file or files over to the project. And this saves, it sort of just stops this problem at source. You know, you can't make any changes to CSS in the live project. It has to be in the pattern library, and so the things don't drift, which I think is really important. The other thing that we learned fairly quickly is that naming stuff is really hard. So, as I say, I started this process being very influenced by Brad Frost's work. So he's got this terminology we've already seen today, you know, this terminology of atoms and molecules. Now, I like that because, again, it's sort of agnostic. It's not tied to any web terminology. It's not tied to stuff which is laden with other sort of things that we care about or we think. So I quite like that. And I thought, well, I've not got a better idea, so I'll start using that. And if you're not familiar with Brad's work, really, this is a great book to check out. I would do so. It's got lots of sort of practical information about working with this stuff and lots of tips. But yeah, you see, he's broken these things down into atoms and molecules and organisms. And yeah, you know, that makes quite a lot of sense. We have little things. We have, you know, a button or a label, and then we might build those together into, you know, a little label next to a form field with a button. And these things get bigger and bigger and grow out. So the concept works really well. But especially with the Perch UI, there's an awful lot of bits. You just ended up with this vast array of stuff and we couldn't find anything. And so Drew and I were spending our days kind of like fishing around the pattern library, looking for patterns, looking for where the things were to make a change. Wasn't working so well. So after some sort of trial and error, we've settled to this system of naming stuff by type of thing, but then breaking down the types of thing into these atoms and molecules and so on. So that kind of works a bit better because we can go to the type of thing first and then see the whole array of different things that are like that inside that type. This kind of works quite well for us. And we also built up some complete views of certain pages just to check how those sort of key views were coming together, how they looked in combination. And this means we didn't need to, you know, spin up a complete version of Perch to see how the UI was starting to come together. And also, because we were working with building a whole, you know, new version of the software, there were points at which we couldn't really spin up a version of Perch with all of the UI in place because it wasn't built yet. You know, the actual UI design was moving ahead of the product for a lot of the time. So being able to do that meant that we could actually see how it would look. And it also meant that I could work on UI while Drew was working on PHP code without getting in each other's way. We could just then take the built patterns and things and put them into Perch when we were ready to do so. But this thing about naming, I think the important thing is not to worry about it when you start, because unless for some reason you have very strict naming conventions around what you're doing that already exist internally, and that, you know, that may well be your situation, but if you don't, you're probably just going to have to work this out as you go along. And you'll discover the best way to name things and group things and store this stuff as you go along. So don't stress too much. Don't spend weeks just thinking about what to call stuff, because you may well change your mind anyway. So, you know, don't be afraid to refactor as you go along. And the key thing is to make sure you've got a tool that lets you do this. And I know I sound like I'm really singing Fractal's praises in this talk, but that was a key thing, was that Fractal let us just move this stuff around when we realized that we needed to. Because Fractal is just basically a structure of folders and files. And so you can just drag them around inside the tree and rename them. And then it builds, and then you've got everything in a new order. So it made it very easy for us to rebuild and to change things around and to refactor and get some sort of system that we felt worked for us as we went along. So here's something that became very interesting as I was working on this and has kind of informed quite a lot of the stuff I've been talking about recently. Because I was sort of calling this reduced test case first development. So the Perch UI needs to work in all of the terrible old browsers that our customers' clients use. So our customers tend to use really up-to-date browsers. They're web designers. But their clients might be using any terrible old thing, you know, because they, you know, they're the end clients, they're end web design company clients, and you know, as people who build websites, that not everybody has updated their version of IE. And so we need to make sure that we don't introduce friction between our customers and their clients by saying, well, you've got to have the latest copy of Chrome, sorry. You know, that's not going to work. We want to reduce friction between people building websites and their clients, not add in another source of it. So we don't intend to make IE9 look exactly the same as everything else, for instance, because we're a tiny team. We don't want to, you know, be spending all of our time with, you know, an ever diminishing returns on that. But we want to make sure that, for instance, if you want to go and edit your website on the terrible old hotel computer and it's running IE9, you can. It might not be perfect. It might, you know, it might all be a little bit, you know, skew with compared to what it looks like in the latest browser, but it works. You can do it. And so that's what we mean by, you know, making sure it works. It's doable. You can edit your content. However, I didn't think about those old browsers while I was working on the UI. I didn't even look. And that probably seems backwards to a lot of you, because I think there's been this sort of idea that, well, what you should do is you should get your experience working in the old things and then maybe add some nice little finishing touches for the new stuff. But the problem is the new stuff is Flexbox and grid layout. The new stuff is so different from what went before that if you build your float-based layout and then say, oh, I'll sprinkle on a bit of grid, you might as well not have bothered. Because what you can actually do with these new tools is completely different to what you could do with the old tools. So you're going to miss out. You're going to not use the power of these new things if you leave it right to the end to add a little bit. And so I've kind of started working in a different way, and this has been very much informed by working with the pattern library. Now, I start with good markup. I've always started with good markup. I've been doing this for 20 years. The best way to make your site accessible and like not fall apart in old browsers is to start with some decent markup. That's what this lives on. So you start with good markup, because if all else fails, you've got that. You've got a well-structured document. You've got something that is going to work in a browser. And then, what does the top-of-the-line experience look like? What does it look like in the good browsers? What, you know, for Perch, that was using Flexbox. It was before Grid had shipped. You know, in my own site, that's using Grid layout. What does that look like? And this lets you have leaner code, because you're not having to add all the cruft for things that went before. It allows you to be creative. It allows you to use Grid, for example, and use the things that are available to you without worrying too much about the past. And once you've done that, you've got all this stuff in the middle. And the middle is changing. And the middle that has the old browsers is shrinking. But if you start having a look at that, so we go and we have a look and we load up some terrible old browser and we look at it like this. But by the time I did this with the Perch UI, I'd been working on this for months, and Drew had been working on this for months. And I got it all loaded up, and I had a look in IE9, which used loads of Flexbox, and I spent, in total, about a day making it tidied up in IE9. Because the thing is, the problem with leaving browser compatibility till the end, if you're working a traditional way, if you're building up all of your pages and everything as this, you know, this big thing and you're building it in the website and you're not sort of thinking in components, then what happens is you load that up in IE9 or whatever an early browser is that you need to get it working in, and you're like, ah, this is going to take me forever and it looks awful. I don't know where to start. And all you can do is start stripping stuff out and reduce it down to a reduced test case so you've got something that you can fix. And that's kind of what we do. You know, if you have to troubleshoot a broken site or a site that's not working in older browsers for some reason and you need to get it so, you end up stripping stuff back, creating reduced test cases and fixing those, working out where the problems are. That's really great advice. But the thing is, what are those components in your pattern library if not a reduced test case? They already are. And so they become very easy to fix. You look at the thing, you're like, well, that's all blown apart because I've used Flexbox and this browser doesn't support Flexbox or it supports old Flexbox. How do I fix that? Oh, well, I could use inline block for that. I can fix that. Fix that one. Fix the next one. And then very soon, you're sort of working through it. There's no big panic. It's not difficult because they're already broken down. They're already a reduced test case. So you work in the pattern library, you test each component for accessibility, for browser compatibility, whatever you need to do, get them all working. You may well find by the time you get to your big layouts, it just works. If you don't, well, your layout really is just a big component into which the other components fit. So you just need to figure out, you know, which combination of things is perhaps, you know, causing a rounding error that causes things to drop into the wrong place or whatever. So you can really treat, you know, particularly with using something like grid layout, you can very much treat your sort of layouts as a big component into which small components fit. And in this way, working pattern library first turns out to be a great way to start using new CSS in a safe way. And for instance, with grid, you know, there's probably most people are going to, if you look at your logs, you're probably now looking at about 70%, 75% of your people coming to your website have got CSS grid support within 3 months of it getting into browsers. So you might think, well, I'd like to start doing this on my site because, you know, over time, we're going to be seeing 80, 90% of people fairly quickly with grid support, particularly once Edge ships their update. So, for example, you know, we might create a component here using grid. I had to have a little bit of grid code on my slides, just a little. So I'm creating here a component using grid, and I'm using something in grid that I can't do easily with other layout methods, because that's a good reason to start using grid layout. So what I'm doing is I want to have some panels that span two rows, which again is something very difficult to do with older layout methods. So here I'm creating this component. I'm going to have as many columns that will fit into my container with a minimum of 200 pixels, maximum of one fraction unit. And my rows will all be a minimum of 150 pixels tall and a maximum of auto, so they'll stretch to contain the content. But crucially, I've got this tall item which I'd like to span two rows. So I've given that a grid row end of span two, which will give us something like this. You can see we have panels which can span two rows. That's a feature of grid that I want to use in my design, which I wouldn't really be able to easily do any other way. So now I look at my non-grid supporting browsers. And if they've got no grid, it's going to lay out in block layout like this, which is how you'd expect. So the items are going to lay out one below the other. Now, it might be that the component is a small enough part of the design that you think, well, actually, laying out in block layout, that's absolutely fine. That's readable. Looks okay. You could leave it like that. But let's say this would mean that you had lines that spread right out across the design, and you thought, oh, that's not ideal. I don't want that. Now, it would be really hard to get a fallback that had panels neatly spanning two rows without adding a whole load of extra markup into the picture. You think, well, I don't want to do that because fewer and fewer people are going to be seeing this and it'd be adding all this extra markup for no gain. So I could get a similar layout, not quite the same, but a similar layout with Flexbox. So here, I'm staying in my component and I'm pretty much able to rely on the fact that flex items, if you make a flex item, a grid item, all of its flex properties just go away. That's defined in the spec. So you can basically overwrite flex items with grid items. So with the flex items, I need to put something on the panel, the flex properties, to give it a width, to shorten the size of those panels. But then if I declare display grid after display flex, once those items become grid items, the flex properties are ignored, so I can just leave them there. They're not going to work. The important thing is I need to have that CSS in the right order. I need to say display flex first, and then a browser that doesn't support grid uses Flexbox. I then say display grid. The browser that supports grid uses grid and ignores Flexbox. And I've got a little feature query there at the bottom. All I'm doing in that is getting rid of the margin if we are in grid, because I'm using grid gap when I'm in grid layout. And this typically is how I'm dealing with browser support. So all of that is neatly there in the component. And then we get our flex layout like this. It's not quite the same because we don't have the nice extra, you know, double height rows and so on, but it's going to look pretty much okay. And it's a sort of acceptable fallback for our grid layout. So by using a system like Fractal, you can keep your fallback code in the pattern library alongside the up-to-date code. And it's really obvious when you look at it, oh, right, well, that's what that's doing. I know what that's for. And also, keeping it all together in the pattern library like this ensures that because we're using the cascade, we're saying, well, I'm going to do my flex first, and then I'm going to do grid. And we're using the way that CSS works to do this overwriting without needing to kind of totally fork our design. Because we've got it all there in the pattern library as a component, we don't end up with a situation where we accidentally switch that around and end up with flex after grid, and so we overwrite our grid with flex, and then it doesn't work. We don't get the grid effect. And also, because it's all there neatly in that pattern, in that component, in future, we might say, we don't need this fallback code anymore. You know, everyone really has got grid layout, and those that don't, we're just going to fall back to a block layout anyway. And you can just go to each of these components and say, right, let's have this out, and let's get rid of this fallback code. We're not using it anymore. And it's very easy to do that when it's in the component. It is not easy to do that if it is in this massive CSS file somewhere that you're having to sort of pick through and say, are we using this CSS? I don't know. Best keep it there just in case, because that's what happens with CSS. So I think that is probably one of the biggest things that I learned out of doing this is how nicely working in the pattern library can allow us to sort of adopt new CSS in this sort of non-scary way. And so, you know, I really, really love pattern libraries. They've pretty much transformed how I build websites. And everything I do now, it just projects that I'm working on, just me, are starting life in a pattern library because it means I can have this kind of nice structured way of working that doesn't leave my CSS sort of littered with things I'm not sure whether I need or not. So just a few final thoughts from this experience. I'm a developer. I'm not a designer, but I sometimes have to design things in for the company because, you know, we can't always get a designer in to do everything. We're a very small team. I have to design my own stuff. I find it quite overwhelming to design things because I'm not a web designer. I hope I'm a developer with decent enough taste, so I kind of know if something's terrible. But I'm not great at design, and so working with a pattern library makes that a lot easier for me. And I think for people who are less technical, who are more on the design side, working in the pattern library can be really helpful because, you know, if they're trying to get some JavaScript to work or just some complicated CSS, you're working on one little thing at a time. You're not having this whole overwhelming thing that you've got to build and you don't know where to start. You're just looking at this one component. Can I get that working well? And then move on. It's much less overwhelming. Working with CSS in a pattern library, it makes CSS more manageable. You know, I work on CSS. I know that CSS is really, really hard to work with as a team. And I think that the whole industry is trying to figure out at the moment how we do that, how we build big projects and use CSS in a good way and sort of don't end up with a whole load of stuff that we don't need. You know, how do we do that? I think pattern libraries are a very good way to start organizing and working with CSS. Keeping all of your build process in the pattern library, it keeps your site projects clean, and it lets you experiment in the pattern library with individual components before that gets out onto the site. And those components, they're reduced test cases, so they really do let you start to work with new techniques, try them out, get them all, so all the troubleshooting done in the pattern library in a safe way before that goes out onto the site. I think it really does let you start to push the boundaries as to what you're using in terms of new techniques without feeling like you're going to blow up your entire site when you do so. You know, don't stress the naming and the organization, but make sure you're using a tool that's going to let you change your mind as you go through, because you will change your mind, and you don't want to be tied to a pattern library that doesn't reflect how you want to organize things, because that's just going to be a constant source of pain. And try and figure out a way to make the pattern library your source of truth. If you have to work in it to create new CSS, then that will make sure it is up to date. If you don't have to work in it, then you're going to have to somehow design a process that always gets stuff back into it. Otherwise, you're going to have a drift between your project and your pattern library, which is not what you want, because people will then stop using the pattern library if they discover it isn't reliable anymore. Those are just a few links from this presentation. I've got lots of grid stuff. If you haven't seen the grid stuff before and are intrigued by that grid by example, you can go and have a look. And there's lots of little components basically there which you could sort of drop in and use in your pattern libraries. So I hope that this has been somewhat useful. The slides will be found there. I'm sort of around and very happy to chat about this stuff. So thank you very much for listening.